Welcome back to the program. For most of us, when we think about China, it's in the context of thinking about 1.3 billion Chinese people as a kind of monolithic nationality and culture. We see a growing international power, a competitor, a confusing, almost alien landscape. Perhaps because its culture and language is so different, the only way for a Westerner to truly understand China is from the inside out, to be a part of it, to be of it, not to be an outsider looking in. That is precisely what my guest Deborah Fallows did during her 3 years living in China with her family and her husband, distinguished journalist James Fallows. Deborah has written a story that is part memoir, part travelogue, part psychological profile, and really should be required reading for anyone visiting or doing business in China. Deborah Fallows has lived in Shanghai and Beijing and traveled throughout China for 3 years. She's a Harvard graduate, she has a PhD in linguistics, and is the author of the previous book, A Mother's Work. It is my pleasure to welcome Deborah Fallows here to talk about her book, Dreaming in Chinese. Deborah, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Jeff. Great to be here.
After 3 years there, did you feel like you understood the Chinese?
Oh, no. I think it would probably take a lifetime. I mean, it's one of those cases where the more you learn, the more you realize you don't know. I mean, certainly you get to a different level from when you first arrived and are just completely overwhelmed and underwater. But you get a little used to the lifestyle and so forth. But with 1.3 billion people of 50 ethnic minority groups, 6 major languages, you know, geography that's as big as the U.S., hundreds of millions of peasants, incredibly rich people, it's hard to make generalizations, and it's hard to say that to claim that you really understand them and know them, but you get somewhere.
Right. And yet the assumption is for Westerners, for Americans in particular, I suppose, is always to think of it as kind of a monolithic culture, as a monolithic nationality. And that doesn't really serve us very well.
No, and it's hard to not think that way, especially at the beginning when you just read what news coverage you can, and it's usually about the kind of headline news things that are going on, or the trade war tensions, or the great economic rise. And what you feel that's quite different when you're there is that really it's a lot of people just trying an effort to better their own personal lives, and the federal and the national government trying to keep its own country on the move and to better life for its people rather than to take over the world or to threaten us. I guess our main message was China is here to stay. It's a big country. It's a powerful country. And our mission is not to fear them, but to get to know them a little better so that we can all live in the same world and learn from each other.
You touch on something important, which is that China, like many other countries in the world, and we forget this sometimes, really, for them, it takes all the running they can do to just hold it together for themselves and, as you say, to keep moving forward at the pace they want to.
Yeah, that's really true. And we heard this this funny statement from the Chinese. You know, we think of it as a country of 1.3 billion people working together. And the Chinese actually think of it as everything they have divided by 1.3 billion people and trying to kind of spread it around so that everybody can get a bit.
Talk a little bit about language and the importance of language. You talk a lot about this in the book, the importance of language and understanding the language or trying to as a way in, as a way to better understand the culture and the way people interact with each other.
Sure. Well, When we first got to China, we were there just by ourselves. We had no handlers, we had no fixers, so we knew that everything would land on our shoulders, from how you sort out your everyday life to move around and to do our own work there. So since I'm the linguist in the family, I have a long background in languages and linguistics, I realized that was my mission, was to try to learn as much of the language as I could, which was pretty darn challenging because this was a language that was unlike anything I'd ever studied. It took me a long time to get a grip on anything because the grammar is so different, the sound system is so different. It all kind of sounded the same at the beginning. And what I realized as I was getting a little bit better in this language, that it was not only functional, it was not only our survival from day to day, but it was really my way to get a little telescope into interpreting what I was seeing on the street. I was using the language as my way into demystifying things that I saw, or getting a little grip on doing more than just survival in the language. Interestingly, a lot of the other expats I came to know in China, the ones who were the most happy were also ones who had some kind of passion, like I did, about language, mm-hmm. about anything. Maybe it was about cooking, maybe it was about photography, or whatever, to use as their way into the culture, to just kind of find an avenue where they were familiar and could get a grounding and move forward with understanding it. Language is certainly a great way, but it's because it tells so much about the culture, but it's not the only way.
Talk a little bit about the specific ways in which language provides that insight into the culture, ways
sure.
in which understanding the language and the idioms really takes you inside the culture in ways that you might not otherwise have been able to.
Yeah, well, here's an example. As I learned more and more Mandarin, I realized whenever I was speaking, I had this odd sensation that I was being very abrupt or very rude about what I was saying. There are very few pleases and thank yous in the language. If you're, say, at a restaurant and the server says, "Would you like a glass of water to start?" in Chinese, instead of the appropriate answer is simply "Buyao," don't need. There's no please, there's no thank you, there's no, "Oh no, thanks, I think I'll have a little bit later, thanks a lot, I'm not really thirsty now, thank you very much." There are none of those kind of softeners going on in the language. So that this is really strange, because what you see is not often a good match with what you hear. And say in a restaurant, what I would see is at maybe the next table where there's a bunch of good friends together having dinner, you see the host pouring beer for everybody else before pouring it for himself. Or maybe the woman at the table using her chopsticks and very delicately choosing out the best morsels of the vegetables or the chicken, putting it on everyone else's individual plate before serving for herself. So it's this really nice kind of choreography of politeness going on. Then, in the midst of it, you'll hear something like "Gei wo yan," which is the equivalent of "Give me the salt," with no pleases and no thank yous. Just, you know, it's all you can do to stop from running over there and say please. And then, so I started asking my friends about this. What's going on? Why do I see polite behavior and hear what sounds to me like very impolite language? And the explanation is really interesting. I read this both in some linguistics books and heard it from my friends, that in the Chinese culture, when you use these softeners, the pleases and the thank yous, it actually serves to insert a kind of buffer, a distance between you and the very good friends who are next to you, that indicates a degree of formality. It's in effect saying, okay, we need some space between you and me here now. We're not such good friends. And so that's where the please and the thank you comes in. So if you're with your good friends and you're saying please and thank you, it's like, "Oh, what did I do wrong? What's wrong? Why are you saying please and thank you to me?" One of my tutors even said, using those pleases and thank yous is like saying please and thank you to yourself. It just doesn't make any sense. It sets this distance apart from you. So our sense of the language is this whole mixture of how the language works and how it fits in with the culture around something like politeness works just in a completely different system in China as it does for the way we've been raised in our sensibilities.
And layered onto that is the tonal quality of the language and how it sounds and how important it is getting that right.
The tones are the nemesis, a major one issue, I think, of every non-Chinese native speaker who's trying to master the language, because you have a really small inventory of syllables in the language, only 400 as opposed to English that has 4,000. So it all kind of sounds the same. You have ma, shi, ta, wu, hao. And not a lot to work with, but the tones are a very clever way out of this. Every time you have a small syllable like ma, each different tone that you put on it changes the meaning of the word entirely. So ma with a high tone means mom or mother. Ma with a falling rising tone means horse. Ma with a falling tone means like I swear or the cursing sound. So it's critical to say those particular words with the proper tone. Otherwise, you're saying something entirely different. It's hard for us because we don't have tones like that. It's hard to hear, it's hard to say, and it's an extraordinarily hard to remember because they're just all so arbitrary. And you can imagine how bollocksed up we all sound to the Chinese who are listening to this and trying to imagine what in the world this foreigner is trying to say and using the wrong tones.
Talk a little about the reverse of all of this, Deborah, the way in which the Chinese try to understand Westerners, Americans in particular, through the language, and again, the similar kind of problem we talked about in the other direction, seeing Westerners and Americans in kind of a monolithic way.
Yeah, well, it's hard because China is only beginning to have a lot of exposure to Westerners, too, and I've heard a lot of them say, for example, with this kind of politeness, oh, you're Westerners, you're always saying thank you all the time, and it sounds so gratuitous and hollow and meaningless. Similarly, there's a really interesting case with the word love, to love, ai, that you hear. Here's a typical example. We had a lot of Western Chinese friends who were couples, you know, in mixed relationships. And around the word love, you'd eventually hear this kind of complaint coming from both sides, where the Western half of the couple would always say, oh, my husband, my wife, my Chinese husband, my Chinese wife, she'll never say I love you. She won't say it in Chinese. She won't say it in English. She just can't come out with that word. The Chinese, on the other hand, will complain about the Western half of the couple. Oh, my husband, my spouse, always saying, I love you, I love you, I love you. It's just so gratuitous. It's just so hollow. It's just kind of tossed out there. So, you know, there are certain sensibilities with certain words. One of them is love. Another of them is this kind of polite language where, since it's not part of a comfortably used part of the language, they hear us tossing around these terms all of the time in what we think is Chinese, and it sounds, you know, really fake and really contrived and really hollow. Mm-hmm. So it's just as hard from their perspective to figure out what are these guys trying to say to us, and why are they sounding so kind of off the mark with things. And of course, if it's not in your realm of experience or in the parameters of how you define romance or politeness to use those words a lot, it's hard to imagine what's going on and why we're saying these things.
There does seem to be a greater willingness, a greater openness to deal with foreigners and to try and understand the imprecise use of the language by people that are trying than there are in other cultures and other situations. You know, people talk about the French, but certainly the Japanese are another example.
Yeah, you know, we lived in Japan for a couple of years, quite a long time ago, and found a very interesting contrast. People had always said to us, and you kind of can't believe it until you see it or experience yourself, that the Chinese are actually quite like Americans in their temperament and personality. Certainly, we came to think that was true, and it was, say, in contrast to the French or to the Japanese, whom we love, of course, but are just really different from Americans. The Chinese have, I would say, that we share with them a kind of lightness of spirit and sense of humor and outgoingness, that it's really easy to be there and to find these kind of this sense of chemistry that's easy to get along, which is surprising because it's not what your first impression seems, where you think of the Chinese as kind of very harsh and very aggressive. But you'll see a very definite playfulness. Say, we're in a restaurant and all the waiters are, you know, in the back by the kitchen. You look over there and you see them having a fork fight. They're kind of tossing forks back at each other, trying to fork each other, and you think, we think that's really funny, and they think that's really funny, and it's not the way you think of French waiters behaving or Japanese waiters behaving. The other way this comes through, I think, is that it's actually really easy to be a Westerner in China. They're so busy, the Chinese are so busy kind of taking care of their own lives and trying to take care of their own business that you can move around as a Westerner with some sense of anonymity, that people don't really care that much about you. You know, they're just going on about their own business, and they'll kind of look at you and say, and nod or be nice or incorporate you into their day and try to, you know, take care of your problems that you're having with them, and then move on to their own business. You don't feel like you're on stage or up for show, or that people are scrutinizing you or disapproving of you in a way that you do in some other countries. It's, in a way, it's a big relief to go to China as an American because you're much more anonymous than I certainly would have guessed before we got there.
How much does that have to do with the density of the population and the way Chinese feel about being individualistic or anonymous?
Yeah, well, yes, it's the answer to both of those things. It's, you know, it's kind of every man for himself in China. There's so many people. There is relatively so little to go around that you're on the move to try to better your life or get your kid in school or get a nicer apartment or move from a bike to a motor scooter to a car or simply get your space on the sidewalk that, you know, you're moving ahead as your own individual way, which is not unlike the way Americans do, actually. And it is, you do get the feeling it's a country of 1.3 individuals. Interestingly enough, one way this is kind of, that you see this is in the working life of people. You know, it used to be that everybody worked for the state, and the state organized your life from birth to death, from where you went to school, where you got whatever social services you got, what factories you worked in, who arranged your funeral. Now, of course, it's changing, and you see this incredible entrepreneurial sense coming out of the Chinese people. You've still got a huge number of people working in factories, of course, and in the fields, and also some people working for the state and state-owned enterprises. But everywhere you look, you get this sense of this tremendous entrepreneurial spirit. You can't walk down the street in Shanghai without seeing all these people figuring out his own little enterprise. You see the guy riding a tricycle down the street, pulling a little cart that's piled at least 12 feet high with this unwieldy collection of styrofoam packing material that he's going to sell somewhere. Or another person riding a push cart that's piled high with the old coal bricks compressed coal that are made into bricks that you still use to burn for heat in a lot of the old Beijing apartments. Or the girls who might have an office job, in the evening they turn into little entrepreneurs and they'll spread out a blanket on the sidewalk and have jewelry that they've made or have gone to the market and buy wholesale bunch of gloves in the winter or hair clips in the summer. And street upon street upon street of little, couldn't call them shopkeepers, but kind of blanket keepers on the sidewalk trying to figure out a little business to get going and make a few extra kwai. So the entrepreneurial spirit is very strong. I'll tell you about one who is really interesting. One of the definite bonuses of being a Westerner in China, well, it's both a pro and a con. The con is that we're all larger in size. You know, I'm taller than most Chinese, and it's, you can't buy normal clothes there. If you go into the into any normal retail shop, everything's just way too small, way too short, way too tight. So you get to go to a tailor and have these wonderful clothes made at very inexpensive prices. So in Shanghai, my Shanghai tailor, who was about my age, had been in the Cultural Revolution. She had been from a kind of dicey family, and like all of her friends, for all of her friends, school was closed, no school classes to go to. All of the kids were sent out to the countryside. All of her friends were sent out to the countryside to work on farms. And she actually was assigned to a textile factory in Shanghai. She was really disappointed, which is actually a very curious thing. But, you know, back in the day, you wanted to be kind of part of this state movement. If you were a youth and sent out to the countryside, you were working for the country. And so she was disappointed because she had to stay in a factory in Shanghai, and then thought, okay, I'm going to make the best of this. I'm going to learn as much as possible about textiles. I'm going to learn how to be a tailor. Fast forward 40, 50 years later, and she has this very entrepreneurial, incredible one-person tailoring business going on from her own apartment, where she makes these exquisite clothes and is really quite extraordinary, and says, how ironic is this? You know, during the Cultural Revolution, I was in the factory learning how, for the good of the state, all to be a textile person, and now I've got this tremendous little business, capitalist business, going on out of my own apartment. It's and that's the shift that you feel so quickly happening in the country all over.
It is one of the other things that there's similarity in terms of this work ethic with Americans and Chinese, because that work ethic is very different in places like Japan or France. I mean, the work seems to be one of the other common factors.
Well, work, you know, work is the way out and work is the way up. So if you're, the more you get to do, the more opportunity you seize, the better your life is going to be. And of course, that's easier for people with education and people who figure out entrepreneurial things, but it also comes out in curious ways now with the meeting of the old and the meeting of the new, say, for factory workers down in Shenzhen in southern China, where so many factories are and where all the migrant labor goes to try to get a better life. What happens now is this mix with the new technology. Everybody's got cell phones, right? Everybody's got these mobile phones. And it's becoming a great conduit and kind of messenger system where if you're a worker in a factory, you can plug into this network and find out, okay, which factory is hiring? What are the wages there? What are you getting paid for an hour? And people will very quickly kind of find their way around to who's hiring best and what factory should I look for next. So there's, even in that less entrepreneurial working climate, a great kind of discovery of mobility through this modern technology of how you can sort out what's going to be your best deal and try to make your way among these hundreds of millions of other workers, and how can you get, you know, a little step ahead for yourself and your family.
How is the effort portrayed internally in terms of the Chinese trying to strike this balance between reverence for the cultural history that they really feel a part of and also this rush towards modernity?
Well, I think you see, you know, individual by individual, a curious kind of mixture. I went to a lot of different commercial language schools when we were in China, and I had a lot of different tutors just as we moved around and our life changed, and I was working as hard as I could to keep up with the language but trying to be versatile, not get in a rut, work with our schedules and travel and everything else. And I had one teacher who probably was a really good example of this. His name was Danny. He was in his early 20s, and like a lot of the young people in China, he was a set of contrasts within himself. He was extremely nationalistic about his country. He would defend the richness of the history of China and say, yes, this character system is really impossible for everybody to learn, but you have to understand how it's a living history of our country, and look at any particular character even that you're writing, and you can see where it came from and what the different pieces of this character meant and how it gives a whole concept of what this means to the Chinese people. So you might think we should have an easy phonetic system to write with, but we need this character system. And, you know, this went on to his whole sense of history and family relationships and respect for elders and honoring the authorities in the Chinese government as well. Yet, on the other side, he was, in his early 20s, having a very hard time, kind of hadn't made the cut to get to a fine university, to get to study abroad, to kind of make his way up among all his peers. So he was really scrambling and trying to figure out for himself, how was he going to get out of the country? How was he going to get to Hong Kong to just be part of this new global experience that the Chinese so much want to be part of and want to take part in, and yet are having a hard time maybe making that step into the modern world unless they're in the very elite group. So he was a combination of old and yet the very new, who knew the world was out there and was really struggling to get a grip on it.
In total, how do you think the Chinese experience 3 years there changed you? How did your outlook about the world change as a result of your time in China?
I would say that the biggest sensibility is that it was a humbling experience. When you feel like you know how the world works when you're living in the U.S., you've been there most of your life, you get up every morning, you kind of anticipate what is going to happen, and whatever gets thrown in your way, you have the tools to know how to deal with it. Then suddenly you're in a country like China, which is so totally alien to us, but you realize that the Chinese people in their lifetimes have seen so much and dealt with such enormous problems that how they are trying to get through their daily lives makes ours seem like a cakewalk. You know, if you were born, you can see this in the generations. You can see this in the faces of the people that you pass on the sidewalks. If you were born in, say, 1950, you kind of missed all the end of dynastic China and the beginning of the republic, but you saw the beginning of the communist era, the Cultural Revolution, your family was split apart, your education was stopped. You had to figure out how to kind of get back in the system and operate as a single person. And then you see the change into China coming out of the Cultural Revolution, opening up to modern times, figuring out how it's going to change into a different economic system and be a different kind of global player. And it all comes down to how individuals cope with these tremendous life changes that are of epic proportions within a generation of time. So as a Westerner living this cushy life, you know, I'm thinking back, I was worried about my senior prom, and this woman I'm talking to was wondering where she would be sent out in the countryside and when she would ever get back to school. It can't help but be an incredibly humbling situation.
Deborah Fallows, her book is Dreaming in Chinese, Mandarin Lessons in Life, Love, and Language. Deborah, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Thanks very much, Jeff. It was a pleasure.